All right, our next case and our final case of the day is State versus Jackson. And Ms. Dvorak appears via WebEx. We have Ms. Duffy here for the state in the courtroom. And Ms. Dvorak, if you're ready, we will let you proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mary Dvorak and I represent Quamaine Jackson. This is an appeal from a conviction after a jury trial of one count of child abuse resulting in serious bodily injury. Our main issue on appeal has to do with a Batson challenge that was made at the conclusion of jury selection.
Excuse me, our time's not running. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Is my volume okay as well? Are you able to hear me?
Yes, okay. It's not the greatest, but it's okay. Let you know if we have a problem.
Okay, thanks. As the court is aware, the baseline for establishing a Batson challenge there is a three-part test. The first, the defendant has to make a prima facie showing that the government has exercised a peremptory challenge on the basis of race. And then the prosecution is allowed to give a race neutral basis for striking that juror or the jurors at issue. And then in light of that submission, the trial court must determine if the defendant has established purposeful discrimination. Of course, this court's standard of review is for clear error. And we would argue that we have met that burden in this case. There was a veneer of 30 people. There were 24 who were in kind of they were going to be jurors, and then there were six of in the alternate pool. So the prosecution was able to make six strikes of that smaller pool and then exercise two strikes on the alternates. There were three African Americans originally in that veneer, and actually none of those African Americans were in the alternate pool. Mr. Jackson is also African American. Of those three African Americans in the veneer, the state struck two of them. So in other words, they could exercise six strikes and they exercised two of them against African Americans. So that is a third of their peremptory strikes were used against African Americans. We rely primarily on the reasoning in Foster v. Chapman. In our argument, which is essentially if the prosecutor puts forth a reason for striking a black panelist, but that reason is also applicable to a white or a non-black panelist that the state did not strike, then that evidence tends to prove purposeful discrimination. In this case, the two jurors that were struck and are at issue are juror 1 and juror 11. With respect to juror 1, the state claimed that
Dvorak.
Yes,
Your Honor. I'd like to just stop you for a minute before you get into the details of each of these jurors. I have a question for you regarding how to create the record for an appellate court to review situations like this. For example, unlike Foster, where it was, there were after the conviction and an open records request was made, and so they were able to obtain prosecutors' notes from the jury selection. We do not have that benefit here. In fact, unless I'm wrong, I don't think we even have in our record a list of who struck who. Is that correct? We only know who ultimately were struck. We can see that, but we don't know whether the prosecutor struck certain jurors. Okay. We know they struck, but which ones they struck, we don't know.
Right. I believe as part of the argument on the Batson challenge, I think that, counsel's arguments and the judge's deliberations would have indicated that at the very minimum that the state struck juror 1 and juror 11. I think that would also be established by essentially the prosecutor's admissions, when she's arguing as far as why she struck those two jurors. I think that is preserved in terms of it being apparent from the record that the prosecutor is making an admission that those were two of her strikes. So I think as far as that's concerned, I think that record has been established. I understand, we have a limited record because this is direct appeal. We don't have, this was not a motion for new trial. We don't have new evidence. We didn't, this is not kind of a post-conviction issue. I do think that some of the Supreme Court's more recent cases have spoken to that, particularly Flowers v. Mississippi, where the court is saying, in that case, I mean, that it's an egregious history where, this defendant had been retried multiple times by the same prosecutor, and there was, evidence of racially motivated, striking in multiple trials over time. Of course, we don't have that type of record. This was his first trial.
So for example, when questions are asked of the jurors and hands are raised, as is discussed in this challenge, in fact, that there were some hands raised regarding the distrust of police. And this applies to juror number 11 who was struck, correct?
Right.
We can glean from the record that there was another juror, I believe it was number 18, who was actually questioned on the record, who had raised his hand and apparently raised it again when there were follow-up questions, but there seems to be no indication that juror 11 raised her hand again. But we don't know from this record who was that third juror, and did that juror remain impaneled? So is that incumbent on the party raising the challenge to ensure that the record is clear in circumstances like that?
Well, I think likely that line of questioning took place during the prosecution's voir dire. So if the prosecution is going to make that, a sticking point or a reason that they're going to hang their hat on for striking a juror, I think it's incumbent on the prosecution or the state to preserve that. So if they know, that they might want to excuse jurors because of, the issue regarding police, then I think it's incumbent on the prosecution to make a good record indicating who has responded to that question and, follow up. I think otherwise they are subject to, an inference. If you are using a reason, or you're claiming that there's a reason to excuse a juror, but you've avoided engaging the juror on that issue, and we haven't established a record, I think that then their reasoning for excusing that juror is going to be weak. I think with respect to
jurors, wouldn't it help you as the counsel for the defendant, if there's a possibility that there could be a Batson challenge, isn't it helpful to have it stated for the record which jurors are raising their hands when there are questions like, do you distrust the police, for example? And wouldn't it have been helpful to know if the third juror or the other person who raised their hand was kept? If the state didn't strike the other juror who also raised his or her hand, wouldn't that have been helpful on review here?
I agree. I think it's, yes, I think going forward, that's probably the best practice. I still would say that it's on the prosecution to make that record. I do think that there's
your burden though, right? It's the defense burden. If they're going to bring the challenge, it's their burden to make sure the record is going to support their argument.
Well, the thing is, if the prosecution is conducting their voir dire, the defense has limited, it's not your time at the table if they are conducting their voir dire and not, for example, I think, maybe it would be appropriate for a defense attorney to ask, the judge, could you instruct the prosecution to record who is raising their hands? But for example, I think it would go beyond our burden for certainly to ask the court, instruct the prosecution to follow up with, you know, if a prosecutor asks someone to, you know, ask for a show of hands and then asks no follow-up questions, I don't think that it's my, you know, goal as a defense counsel to interject into the prosecution's voir dire. If they want to make their record, they need to make their record, and without me prompting them and kind of, you know, inserting myself into their voir dire. I'm almost out of time. With that, we would ask that the court reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dvorak. Ms. Duffy.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska. As noted in the state's brief, appellant argued 3 errors, but only assigned 2, and the assignment of error related to the sufficiency of the evidence has been waived. And unless this court has specific questions about the excessive sentence claim, I will turn to the Batson challenge. Briefly, the state's overarching position is that the district court correctly overruled the Batson challenge, and we ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Appellant argues his Batson challenge was improperly denied because he claims the state failed to provide race-neutral reasons that were supported by the record for its striking of the 2 jurors that this court has been discussing with opposing counsel, Juror 1 and Juror 11. As it relates to Juror 1, appellant argues the state's reasons applied equally to non-Black jurors who were permitted to serve. The state listed 3 reasons when Juror 1, although they said that first reason that they gave did not have a bearing on choosing to use the strike. So from the state's kind of point of view, that the reason that Juror 1 had some medical issues can kind of be pushed to the side because the prosecutor did state that.
But they subsequently threw it back out there. So the number
I realize they said it, Your Honor. And I'll be the first to say, I have not tried a jury case. I don't practice. And I don't know if the prosecutor just writes down lists or I can't explain that, but the prosecutor did say that that did not have a bearing. And the other 2 reasons given for Juror 1 were that she stated she had disagreed with doctors in the past. Juror 1 was a nurse and stated that she does disagree with doctors about the diagnosis. This was a case where there were gonna be a lot of medical professionals testifying, and it was very medically heavy, was I believe the word the prosecutor used at one point. The other panelists that the appellant compares Juror 1 to did describe times they'd interacted with doctors where maybe there was a misdiagnosis or an inability to make a proper diagnosis. And in one case, feeling that the physician was not fully invested into making a switch. But those are very different from actively disagreeing with the opinion of a medical professional.
I don't think those were the words of that juror, though, were they, that she actively disagreed?
No, Your Honor, I suppose she said, the juror said that she does disagree with doctors about a diagnosis.
That if she disagrees, she does her own investigation at times.
I don't recall her exact, but again, I think that the comparisons that appellant makes when arguing that the proffered reason was pretextual, they're very different scenarios. Disagreeing with a physician and saying, gosh, you know, the doctor wasn't really able to figure out, you know, what was causing my back pain. Those are very different situations.
But wasn't the follow-up with that juror then, if there was a specialist who rendered a diagnosis, that would she find that believable? And that juror responded, yes, believable.
I'm sorry, are you referring to Juror 1 or
yes,
to one of the
one?
I don't recall. I do think, though, that there is support in the record for the state's proffered reason that she does disagree sometimes with physicians and doing her own diagnosis.
Do we know the profession of Juror Number 1?
She was went to nursing school, I believe she said, in the United States, and she attended law school in her home country. But she is a nurse, I believe she said. And
does that play a more important role in the fact that she might disagree with doctors, that she's actually employed with them?
I think that, again, this is a case where the state presented a lot of medical professionals giving their opinion as to the cause of the injuries that the child sustained. And the defense presented the testimony of a medical professional as well that was they were very inopposite, or opposite. And I think, you know, from the state's point of view, again, this, I don't know what the prosecutor's thought process for this, but to me, you know, having someone with medical training saying, yeah, I disagree with people who have other medical training about these things. I it could play a role. It could not. I think the state's point of view was that they wanted people who were going to really take and give a lot of weight and credibility to the medical professionals who were testifying for the state.
And in fact, a juror number 24 was seated and she was a nurse.
I don't recall, Your Honor. That was not raised.
So it wasn't the occupation, apparently.
Apparently, it was the disagreement with.
Which on follow-up, she indicated that she would believe the doctor.
Your Honor, that is a reason. Yes, I don't recall from the record where that is, but that I don't dispute that that was obviously stated.
I'd like to move, if you don't mind, to juror number 11, because yes, there is something in that examination that troubles me a little bit. This is with regard to the distrust of law enforcement. Okay. And the fact that the record is not real clear who the we know who two are. Mm-hmm. Based on the record, but we don't know who the third person was. So we don't know if that person ended up sitting on the jury or not. And my question is, what can we tell from this record that made trust of law enforcement as opposed to the medical profession so critical?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, in this case, we did have obviously a detective testify, and I think, but you know, that's true in most, a lot of criminal cases. Again, I don't have the prosecutor's notes, so I don't know, and I don't think the prosecutor stated on the record why that was so important. But I think obviously in criminal cases, law enforcement does play a big role. And in here, law enforcement conducted a couple of different interviews of both the mother of the victim, and I also, I don't remember how many interviews the appellant, how many times he was contacted by police.
But the thrust of the conviction was how this child was injured in the way she yes. was, not in how law enforcement handled anything.
Well, you know, Your Honor, appellant's position, I believe, in reading the sufficiency of the argument was that the state did not prove that he, you know, didn't prove the mechanism, didn't prove their case. And so I suppose maybe someone who does not trust law enforcement might think, well, maybe they didn't do their job. They didn't properly investigate or.
Can we talk for a second about mm-hmm. the current climate in our country, that when you ask a question like that, and if you have minority people in the veneer, there's a likelihood that hands are going to go up.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think that a person's opinion of law enforcement often comes from their personal experience with law enforcement. And
so, but let's just roll with this for a minute. So let's say every Black person on the jury raises their hand. There was a follow-up question later, and no identification made as to who those jurors were. We know because the judge later says, oh, I remember that juror number 11 was one of the people that raised her hand, okay? And there were two different points, I think, mm-hmm. where this topic came up. So then there was follow-up the second time it came up in juror number 18, when the question was asked, do you believe that this will affect your ability to be fair and impartial in this trial? He still kept his hand up or didn't respond in a way where no one else was called on at that point. So that leaves the perception, mm-hmm. at least, that no one else raised their hand except 18, who was ultimately struck, right? There's nothing to indicate 11 was still holding up her hand that she could not remain fair and impartial in the case. So that being the situation, how is it reasonable to suggest that simply because a juror said in the first instance, raise their hand, do you distrust police, that that's a legitimate basis to strike them in this case, especially?
Well, Your Honor, I guess, so you're, to make sure I really get your, understand your question, your consternation really comes from the failure to have some follow-up engagement with that juror. And I guess, A, to your point, in your discussion with opposing counsel, we don't have a record to know really who raised their hands and when. I think, again, the prosecutor asked the question, juror 11 raised her hand.
And we only know that because the trial judge indicated
correct,
that.
Correct, Your Honor. I will note that the burden rests upon the party challenging the strike, and it never shifts to the other party. I understand as an appellate court, you'd rather just have the information, regardless of who provided it. But I think ultimately, and this court in State v. Varney in 2019, which is an unpublished opinion, but which specifically discussed the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Flowers. This court stated, "The Flowers opinion reminds us that trial judges are primarily responsible for the enforcement of Batson, and these determinations of credibility and demeanor deserve great deference." And I understand, your point. I think ultimately what this comes down to is really, absent exceptional circumstances, the trial court's determination of the credibility that I suppose I should back up a little bit. Case law really holds that often questions of whether the prosecution's reasons are believable or whether they are pretextual often comes down to a question of the credibility of the attorney providing the reason. And that trial courts are really, I believe, and one court described it in the peculiar position of being able to really provide that judgment of credibility, and that those determinations are to be given great deference absent exceptional circumstances. And the state does not believe, as stated in our brief, that the appellant has shown that those exceptional circumstances apply here. And with that, I see that I'm out of time. I am happy to take questions.
I do have one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
One of the things that seems problematic to me in all of this is that we look at very specific questions as to as among jurors. When in reality, when parties are picking a jury and they're getting all kinds of information about all 30 jurors in this case, or potential jurors. And so there's positive points for each side and there's negative points for each side as you're picking a jury. Yet our analysis doesn't seem to allow us to even consider that fact that much. I mean, you look at the cases and we're focusing on those jurors that gave similar answers as opposed to the 35 other topics that come up. And so it's not just an apples to apples comparison in reality, but that seems to be where the case law wants to take us.
Your Honor, and I will say, I really struggle with that because I do think, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court in Miller L. made very clear that it's not you don't have to say juror one is identical to juror five, and therefore if you struck juror one, but I do think language that I really kind of focused on when addressing this issue was from the Nebraska Supreme Court in State v. Clifton. And I think it goes a little to your point. That's 296 NEB 135 in 2017. And Nebraska Supreme Court noted when discussing it said, if a prosecutor's proffered reason for striking an African-American panelist applies just as well to an otherwise similar non-African-American who's permitted to serve, that is evidence to be considered in the third step of the Batson analysis. However, and this is to your point, Judge Arterburn, the same factors used in evaluating a juror may be given different weight depending on the number of peremptory challenges a lawyer has, and a strict comparison analysis may not properly take into account the variety of factors and considerations that may be part of a lawyer's decision to select certain jurors while challenging others that may appear similar. And so I do think that really kind of in getting, you know, that we do sometimes look at, is this juror similar to that juror? But I do think that there maybe is a little room, for example, in Foster, the court didn't just look at were other jurors who were not struck, did they have some similar characteristics? They also focused on the kind of pervasive tone of discrimination that was in the prosecutor's case files and things like that. So it does sometimes feel like we're really trending in this direction of, as you said, pretending that things are apples to apples. But I do think that that's really when it comes back down to the trial court making that credibility determination and the deference that it is afforded on appeal.
It's very difficult to try to establish purposeful discrimination, right? Because none of us can be inside the head of
the
person.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, I think that's when it comes back to that trial court, relying on the trial court's determination of the credibility. And as you noted, Judge Bishop, being able to get those files and things like that in a later kind of continuation of the case. I am now well out of time, Your Honors. I do apologize. If there are no other questions, we request you affirm the judgment.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Duffy. Ms. Dworak, we took Ms. Duffy quite a ways over, and if there is something that prompted further remarks from you, we will give you a couple of minutes to rebut if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge, I think, you know, one of the only things that I would just ask the court to take a second look at is, you know, while we did spend a lot of time on, you know, the issue of comparing jurors, and we talked about apples to apples, and you know, it's difficult on the record to know if, you know, one juror is really comparable to the other juror. But I think one factor that the case law does talk about as being a factor that tends towards a finding of purposeful discrimination is misrepresentations in the record. And this case did have a blatant misrepresentation by the prosecutor, in which she put words into Juror 11's mouth. So when she was allocuting her reasons for striking Juror 11, she represented that Juror 11 flat out said that she has an opinion about police officers. She does not trust police officers. Lo and behold, when we go back and look at the record, Juror 11 said no such thing. The only record that we have is that the trial court noted that Juror 11 raised her hand in response to prosecution's question about suspicion of police. So I think that it should not be ignored that the state misrepresented and elaborated on Juror 11's response, and it is not borne out by the record. Flowers, in particular, cited misrepresentation of the record as a factor to look at that goes into this court's determination. So with that, Judge, I would ask that the court reverse this decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dvorak. The case will be taken under submission. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments today, and you are excused.
Thank you.